This is West Virginia Morning. I'm Chuck Anzalevich. Well, it's almost time to gather around the table to enjoy Thanksgiving food and family and sometimes have awkward conversations about politics or hot-button issues like climate change. The Allegheny Front's Kara Holsopel spoke with the clinical psychologist Mary Beth Manarino on how to navigate different views on these issues.
I'm going to play a clip from the last time that we talked a couple of years ago. And the question I asked was, how do we begin to have a conversation with someone about climate change or any touchy issue? A person that you know or maybe suspect has a different opinion or point of view about it than you do. And here's what you said.
If you reach out and ask the other person about their beliefs and what do they know about climate change, and show a genuine interest in it and why they feel so strongly about it, and then you're meeting them where they are, and then you can say something like, I've done a lot of thinking about this as well because it's potentially very upsetting. And here are some things that I've done to educate myself about it. So that's one of the things, is to meet them where they are and then kind of express yourself in a way that respects that they may be different.
So is that still your advice?
In part, I would stand by that. I think what I'm finding now is that people who are involved in fighting climate change, other environmental issues, or even other political concerns, is that there is a sense of urgency that has increased. And so that potentially brings more energy to the conversation, often on both sides, which can either make it go even better or can really cause it to blow up. So, yes, I stand by meeting them where they are, but I would also go a little deeper and take some risks in talking a little more deeply about it with them.
How would you do that?
I just recently participated in the Climate Reality Leadership Training. And one of the very simple questions that we can ask at those times is, if you meet someone who really doesn't buy into the reality of climate change, you can just simply ask, what about that concerns you the most? And many times you'll find out that there's just a misunderstanding of facts or even a level of avoidance of finding information. So taking the risk to not just kind of accept what the person is saying, but really asking them, what is it about this that concerns you, is something that might take the conversation further.
The Climate Reality Leadership Core Training, that presentation was given in Pittsburgh recently. It's given all over the world, and it's led by, of course, former Vice President Al Gore, as sort of a way to train people really to not only talk about climate change, but to kind of convince people about climate change and take action.
Right. And one of the other things that I would say about this is that if you are passionate about this, find a way to communicate that passion in a positive way. There's a way to do that without denigrating people who don't buy in, but just by example, showing them that you have learned so much and you have so much still to learn, but you're really in it for the long haul because it matters so much to the future of our grandchildren and even our current lives. I think I would honor that passion that you carry about it if you are an activist and not just try to soften that. In psychology, one of the things we talk about a lot is speaking from the I position rather than you, so that you can still stay engaged in a conversation by saying, this is what I believe and this is what I have found out and what I know and why I'm in this, without attacking the other person or assuming something about how they feel.
How do you do that without giving them a bunch of facts? Like, the, you know, that we're warming at this particular rate. And if we keep going, you know, like, you know, there's a lot of facts. I know that Al Gore has a lot of facts.
Al Gore has a lot of facts.
In his books and his presentations. So, you know, how do you do that?
Well, that's a great question. And that's one of the things I've learned through experience, but also that Al Gore himself emphasized, is that most of us have very personal stories that we can draw on to tell people about this. For example, my family is from the mountains of eastern Kentucky, where mining was the major industry. And I have learned a lot about how the fossil fuel extraction and mountaintop removal has devastated communities and people's health. And so when I talk about that from a personal perspective, I can also invite somebody else to talk about experiences that they've had with nature. One of the things I have found in teaching graduate students in psychology and counseling about these issues is that we can't just launch the semester with the facts about these things. And what we do is we actually spend a couple of weeks looking at our personal relationships with nature. And people are invited to think about places that were very special to them for one reason or another, and to go back to remembering the sensory experience of being there and the emotional and spiritual experiences. And then also to imagine, if those places are still intact and thriving, what would it feel like to have that place be devastated by some kind of environmental disaster or cumulative effects of toxins and climate change? And people often have a powerful reaction to that when they can personalize it.
That was Mary Beth Manarino, a professor emeritus at Chatham University. She's also a clinical psychologist, and she was speaking with the Allegheny Front's Kara Holsopel. The Allegheny Front is produced in Pittsburgh and reports on the environment. More at AlleghenyFront.org. Next, we'll hear a story about a woman who loves and writes about an unpopular and often misunderstood animal. Katie Fallon is the author of Vulture, The Private Life of an Unloved Bird. And as she told Roxy Todd, while most humans may not like vultures, without them, our interstates and roads would be overflowing with disease, garbage, and dead animals.
So what about vultures drew you to first be interested in them?
I think vultures are sort of a perfect creature. They don't kill anything. They do a really good job of cleaning up our ecosystem. They're sort of the ultimate recyclers. And they're just very beautiful to watch flying also. They're maybe not as beautiful up close, or they look, you know, kind of wrinkly. And sometimes people say they're even ugly up close, but they're very, very beautiful when they're flying. And you can see them almost every day of the year here in West Virginia. My husband Jesse and I are two of the co-founders of the Avian Conservation Center of Appalachia, where we treat injured birds of really all species of migratory birds. And the turkey vultures especially are just really different from other birds that we treat. When they come in for rehab, when they've been injured, either hit by a car or sometimes shot or suffering from lead poisoning, they just have a different way about them. They really seem to be looking at you and trying to figure things out. And they're timid birds, and they're very charming in a lot of ways, just in kind of their manner of being curious and quiet. Turkey vultures also don't really make any sounds. They don't have the same kind of syrinx or bird voice box that other birds do. So they really only can hiss and sort of make some grunting sounds. So they're just very quiet and very watchful. They're always kind of looking around and seems like they're trying to figure out what's going on.
And in your book, you write about some different cultures have had different feelings for vultures. Even, you know, you write about some Egyptian tombs that have been discovered where there's maybe even a religious connection to vultures. And you also talk about a vulture buzzard festival in Ohio that celebrates the buzzard. Can you talk about some of these signs that not all people throughout all time have really given vultures the bad reputation that maybe we give them today?
Ancient Egyptians were very fond of vultures, and they actually believed that all vultures were female. And part of the reason for that may be that both the male and the female take care of the young, and they look alike in a lot of species. So people may have observed these vultures and thought they were all female. They also observed them regurgitating, bloody bits of food for their young, and they believed that the female vulture was actually harming herself and feeding her babies her blood and her flesh. So female vultures and all vultures, they became like the ideal mother in the eyes of many ancient Egyptians. Then the vulture became the symbol of the protection of the pharaoh. So in a lot of tombs, you can see kind of up in the corner usually a vulture with her wings spread. She's often carrying this round symbol in her talons, which is called the shen, which is the symbol of eternity. So vultures kind of creating life from death in a, kind of a perfect cycle. Things die and the vulture eats them and then lives and creates more life. So the vulture was seen as the protector of the pharaohs. And she was also sort of the goddess who protected women in childbirth. Because the ancient Egyptians believed they were such ideal mothers that the vulture goddess would even protect women going through this process. So they were very fond of vultures in ancient Egypt. A lot of people today aren't quite as fond as vultures, but there are some. It's not just me. There's a vulture festival every year in March in Hinckley, Ohio. It's called Buzzard Sunday. And it's usually right around St. Patrick's Day, and it's been celebrated since, I believe, the 1950s on this day. It's usually when the vultures come back to Hinckley, Ohio, after being kind of away for the winter, they consider it the first sign of spring. When the vultures come back to Hinckley, Ohio, spring has arrived. And there's a really cool festival with pancake and sausage breakfast. Kids with hanging their artwork up everywhere, their vulture artwork. There are people dressed as vultures. There are educational displays and presentations about vulture natural history. There is an official buzzard spotter, so a person who kind of stands up on a platform and counts the birds as they come into the area. It's a lot of fun. There's music. it's a great thing to check out, and it is definitely sort of, wow, the winter is ending. Here we are in spring. These birds are back.
Well, Katie, thanks for sharing these reflections on vultures. And Katie Fallon is the author of Vulture, The Private Life of an Unloved Bird.
West Virginia Morning is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. You can keep up with the latest West Virginia news throughout the day on our website, wvpublic.org. Support for our news bureaus comes from West Virginia University, Concord University, and Shepherd University. Our producer is Glennis Board. I'm Chuck Ann Zlevich.